Life is unpredictable, but preparing for the unexpected shouldn't be. Take ownership of your life planning with Policy Genius to help your loved ones have a financial safety net in case something happens to you. They offer life insurance policies starting at just $276 a year for $1 million in coverage. Don't wait for life to make other plans. Protect your family today. Head to PolicyGenius.com. That's PolicyGenius.com.
Welcome to the Jeep Dive, where we sift through mountains of information to uncover the most impactful insights for you. Today, well, we're tackling a question that kind of echoes through rock history. How does a band not just hang on, but actually thrive for, what, over 60 years now?
It's more than just sticking around, isn't it? It's about staying vital, staying relevant.
Exactly. We're talking about a cultural force, a phenomenon that's just consistently defied time, trends, maybe even itself sometimes.
Indeed. So today we're doing a deep dive into the phenomenal, the enduring legacy of the Rolling Stones. Our mission really is to unpack the key moments, some surprising facts maybe, their incredible musical journey, and just that sheer resilience that led people to call them, you know, the greatest rock and roll band in the world.
Yeah, that title. We'll get into that. And to do it, we've dug through a whole stack of sources for you. Historical docs, discographies, biographies, critical takes, the lot. We're going to try and guide you through their amazing, and let's be honest, often a pretty wild journey.
It's quite a ride. So expect everything from their bluesy London roots, those defining rivalries, you know, the Beatles comparisons.
Right. And then the huge stadium tours, the personal dramas, the iconic logo, that sound that just kept changing and evolving.
We should find some real aha moments. And yeah, probably a few laughs too.
Okay, let's rewind way back to the very start. The genesis of these giants. We're talking late 50s, early 60s, laying that blues foundation. It really starts with a chance meeting, doesn't it?
It does. And it's funny, before they were Mick and Keith, they were just kids. Classmates, actually. Childhood friends in Dartford, Kent, way back in 1950.
Wow, that early.
Yeah. And even then, Jagger, with his mate Dick Taylor, was already seriously into American blues and R&B. You know, the real foundational stuff. Muddy Waters, Chuck Berry, Bo Diddley. For them, it wasn't just tunes. It was like an education.
A passion, yeah. So they knew each other as kids, but then Jagger's family moved. Right?
Right, they lost touch for a bit until this almost unbelievable moment, October 17th, 1961, Platform 2, Dartford Railway Station. They literally bump into each other.
No way.
Yeah, and Jagger's carrying these records, Chuck Berry, Muddy Waters, and Richard sees them and instantly, bam, that shared musical DNA clicks. That moment, just on a train platform, that's the spark for maybe the most legendary partnership in rock.
It shows how these huge things can start from something so small, just a shared interest.
Absolutely. And they didn't waste time. Richards and Taylor started hanging out at Jagger's place, listening to records, figuring things out. By late 61, they'd roped in a couple of others, Alan Etherington and Bob Beckwith, and they had this little jam group called the Blues Boys.
The Blues Boys, okay. Their first kind of band.
Pretty much. Informal, but crucial. Laying the groundwork, you know, getting that chemistry going.
So the spark's there. The Blues Boys are jamming, but how do we get to the Rolling Stones? Putting together that original lineup, that's a whole story in itself.
It really is. And a key place was the Ealing Jazz Club. Around March, April 62, some of the Blues Boys read about it in Jazz News. It was the place for R&B in London then. Alexis Corner's Blues Incorporated played there.
Ah, Alexis Corner. Huge influence.
Massive. Jagger and Richards actually sent him a tape, pretty bold, and Corner was apparently impressed. So they go down to the club, and who do they meet? Brian Jones, Ian Stewart, Charlie Watts, all playing with Corner. It was like a magnet for talent there.
So everyone's kind of orbiting this same scene.
Yeah.
And then people start shifting around.
Exactly. Musical chairs, like you said. Jagger, Richards, and Dick Taylor eventually leave Blues Incorporated to team up with Jones and Stewart. But it wasn't instantly smooth sailing. Early rehearsals, some of the more trad jazz guys, they weren't keen on the raw Chuck Berry, Bo Diddley stuff that Jagger and Richards loved.
Ah, so the blues rock direction was kind of fought for right from the start.
It definitely underscored their path.
Yeah.
And the name, who actually came up with the Rolling Stones?
Good question.
According to Keith, it was totally on the fly. Brian Jones was on the phone with Jazz News trying to book a gig. They ask, what's the band's name? Jones looks down, sees a Muddy Waters LP on the floor, track title, Rolling Stone.
And that was it, just like that.
It's just like that. Perfect name, really, straight from the source. And you have to remember, in those very early days, Brian Jones was really seen as the leader. uncontested leader, Richard said, he was key to getting them going.
Right. Okay, so we've got the name, the core group is forming, they have this bleazy sound.
Yeah.
But they need gigs and a manager, right? That seems crucial.
Absolutely crucial. Their first official gig as the Rolling Stones was July 12th, 1962 at the Marquee Club in London. Jones, Jagger, Richard, Stewart, Taylor. But the rhythm section wasn't locked yet.
Still missing Wyman and Watts in the classic lineup.
Exactly. Bill Wyman didn't join until December 62. He auditions, and apparently they were impressed not just by his playing, but by his gear. He had a good bass, and crucially, those Vox AC30 amps.
Huh. The gear factor. Always important.
Always. And then, the final piece, Charlie Watts. The classic lineup with Charlie on drums plays its first public gig in January 63, Ealing Jazz Club again. He becomes permanent a month later. That jazz swing he had, that was different.
And then comes the manager, Andrew Log Oldham.
Yes, May 1963. He was young, only 19, had ties to Brian Epstein, the Beatles manager. Oldham saw the Stones and immediately got this vision.
The anti-Beatles vision.
Precisely. He saw the Beatles' clean image and thought, right, we go the other way. He deliberately crafted that bad boy image, encouraged the mismatched clothes, the long hair, the unclean appearance. His words were like, a raunchy, gamey, unpredictable bunch of undesirables.
Wow. He really went for it. Threatening, uncouth, and animalistic.
Yeah.
That was a strategy.
A brilliant marketing strategy, really. Carving out their own space, and he was pretty ruthless about it. Take Ian Stewart.
The piano player. Founding member.
Yeah. Fantastic player. But Oldham took him out of the official lineup. Why?
Well, he just doesn't look the part, Oldham apparently said. And six is too many for fans to remember the faces.
Harsh, but focused on that image.
Laser focused. Thankfully, Stewart stayed on. Road manager, session keys, played offstage for years, eventually back on stage. He was always part of the family, really.
Okay, image sorted, lineup solidifying, time to get into the studio. And their Decca deal. That was interesting too, wasn't it?
Pretty interesting. Decca, of course, famously passed on the Beatles. Maybe they learned their lesson. They gave the Stones a really good deal for the time. High royalties, artistic control. They even owned their master tapes, which was almost unheard of then.
That's huge leverage for a new band.
Massive. They liked recording at Regent Sound Studios. Pretty basic mono plays. And Oldham, with zero production experience, just steps in as producer, creates this wall of noise sound that just worked for their raw energy.
Their first single. A cover.
Yeah, Chuck Berry's. Come on. June 63. Got to number 21 UK. Funnily enough, the band apparently hated playing it live. Too poppy.
But it charted. How?
Oldham's strategy again. Got the fan club members to go out and buy copies in the shops that the chart compilers pulled. Bit cheeky, but it worked.
Clever. And the second single had a Beatles connection.
It did. Yeah. Lennon McCartney gave him, I Wanna Be Your Man. Got to number 13 UK. That direct link between the two biggest bands is pretty cool.
And that led to TV.
Yep. January 1st, 1964. First band ever on BBC's Top of the Pops playing I Wanna Be Your Man. Big moment. And Oldham kept pushing Jagger and Richards, write your own songs.
Which they weren't sure about at first.
Richards said their early stuff sounded soppy and imitative. But then their original started charting, and as he put it, that gave us extraordinary confidence to carry on. Their first album in 64 was mostly covers, showing their roots, but it had one Jagger Richards original, plus a couple credited to Nankerfeld.
Jim Nankerfeld.
That was their collective pseudonym for group compositions. Just a way to share the credit, I guess.
Right. So 1964 ends. They've got a UK footing. Let's move into Act Two, 65 to 72. This is where they really explode.
Right.
The ascent to superstardom. But America wasn't instant love.
Oh, definitely not. That first U.S. tour, June 64, Bill Wyman flat out called it a disaster. No hit record there yet. And they got mocked on national TV. Dean Martin on the Hollywood Palace made fun of their hair, their look.
Ouch. Dino making fun of you. That must have stung.
Yeah, a sign their bad boy thing wasn't quite clicking stateside yet. But there was a crucial upside to that trip.
Which was?
Chess Studios. Chicago, they spent 2 days recording there, hallowed ground, you know. And they met their heroes. Muddy Waters himself was there, apparently asked if they were going to help him paint the ceiling.
Huh, that's amazing. Meeting Muddy Waters at Chess, that must have felt like validation.
Totally, a spiritual pilgrimage almost. But things really turned around with I Can't Get No Satisfaction, recorded May 65 on their third U.S. tour.
And that riff, Keith's Fuzzbox riff, iconic doesn't even cover it.
It really is. And apparently that fuzz tone was almost an accident. He used a Maestro FZ1 fuzz tone pedal, intending it as a guide for a horn section he planned to add later.
But the fuzz stayed.
The fuzz stayed. And it became the sound. Raw, aggressive, totally new. That riff, born from a placeholder idea, defined the song and arguably launched a whole new era of guitar tones. It shot to number one in the US, their first. Worldwide smash.
And Keith said, the last time, the single before it, was like the bridge, right? Giving them the confidence to write for the Stones.
Exactly. Satisfaction blew the doors open, but the last time showed them they could write hits themselves. After Satisfaction, it was just hit after hit. Get Off of My Cloud later in 65, and Paint It Black in 66. Global number ones. They were consolidating.
And with that success, they started experimenting more musically. This is where Brian Jones really shines, is in adding all those different textures.
Absolutely. Aftermath, Spring 66. Huge album. First one with only Jagger Richards songs. A massive step creatively. And Jones was just playing everything. Sitar on Paint It Black.
That iconic sound.
Dulcimer on Lady Jane. Marimbas on Under My Thumb. He was bringing in all these exotic sounds, pushing them way beyond just blues rock. He was crucial to that expansion.
They were tackling some heavier lyrical themes, too. Mother's Little Helper.
Yeah, 66, one of the first pop songs to really talk about prescription drug abuse, those little yellow pills, pre-bald for the time, showed they weren't afraid of touching on darker social stuff.
Then came the big psychedelic detour. Their Satanic Majesty's Request.
December 67. Yeah, their answer to Sgt. Pepper's, I suppose. Elaborate cover, psychedelic sounds. But the reviews were pretty harsh, weren't they?
Generally unfavorable, yeah. Seen by many as them trying too hard to copy the Beatles. Though Bill Wyman got a song on there.
He did, In Another Land. Sang lead, too. A rare moment for him creatively on record.
This whole period, though, it wasn't just music. It was chaos, right? Controversies, drug busts. The Redlands raid sounds like a turning point.
Oh, the Redlands raid was massive. February 67, police raid Keith's country house, Redlands. Tip-off came from his chauffeur, apparently.
Mm-hmm.
Jagger Richards and their art dealer friend Robert Frazier all got charged with drug offenses.
And Keith said that's when the fun stopped.
Yeah, his quote was something like, it suddenly made us realize that this was a whole different ballgame. The scrutiny, the pressure from authorities, it ramped up intensely.
And the sentences were heavy, initially.
Seriously heavy? Jagger got 3 months for amphetamine possession. Richards got a year for allowing cannabis smoking. They were briefly jailed, then bailed, pending appeal. The public reaction was huge.
That famous editorial on the Times. Who breaks a butterfly upon a wheel?
Exactly. William Rees Mogg's piece. Powerful stuff, questioning the severity, framing it as persecution. It really shifted public opinion.
And the band responded with a song.
We love you. Kind of a thank you to the fans for their support. Starts with that chilling sound of prison doors slamming. The video even referenced Oscar Wilde's trial. It was defiant. And ultimately, the appeal worked. Richard's conviction overturned, Jagger's sentence reduced to basically nothing. A big win.
But while they were fighting the law, things were fracturing inside the band too, especially around Brian Jones.
Yeah, sadly. His health, his drug use, it was getting worse. And then during a trip to Morocco, his girlfriend Anita Pallenberg left him for Keith. Richards called that the final nail in the coffin for their relationship, just adding personal tragedy to the mix.
It's a lot to handle. But then, out of this chaos, comes what many call the greatest rock and roll band era. Starting with a return to their roots.
Beggar's Banquet, 1968. Yes! Back to the blues, back to the grit. And their first album with producer Jimmy Miller, who was just perfect for them.
And some absolute classics on there. Sympathy for the Devil.
With those woo-woo vocals, yeah. And Street Fighting Man, directly tapping into the revolutionary vibe of 68, the student protests. Though the album itself got delayed, right? Because of the cover.
The toilet cover. Yeah, the label balked at the graffiti-covered bathroom wall. Took 6 months to get it released with a different cover initially.
Always pushing boundaries.
Mm.
But this period also saw the tragic end of Brian Jones's time with the band.
His contributions were dwindling.
Severely. Jagger said he just wasn't psychologically suited to the lifestyle anymore. The drugs were taking a heavy toll. He officially left in June 1969. And then, less than a month later, he drowned in his swimming pool. Just 27.
Such a shock. And they had a concert planned just days later.
Yeah, a free concert in Hyde Park. They decided to go ahead, make it a tribute to Brian. It must have been incredibly difficult. Jagger read Shelley's Adonis. They released thousands of butterflies.
And this was Mick Taylor's debut, Jones's replacement.
It was. Taylor, the young guitar prodigy John Mayall recommended, playing his first gig with the Stones in front of, what, 250,000 people. Incredibly poignant, emotional day.
And that's where the famous introduction started.
Apparently so. Stage manager Sam Cutler grabs the mic. Let's welcome the greatest rock and roll band in the world. He kept using it on the U.S. tour later that year. It just stuck. Bold claim, but they started living up to it.
And 1969 also gave us Let It Bleed, another monster album.
Absolutely. Gimme Shelter with Mary Clayton's absolutely searing guest vocal.
Yeah.
Chills every time.
Still does.
Yeah.
And you can't always get what you want with the London Back Choir. Epic.
Such a range on that album. But the year ended so darkly. Altamont.
Yeah, the Altamont free concert, December 69. It's supposed to be a West Coast Woodstock, but it just went wrong.
Horribly wrong.
Yeah.
Hell's Angels, hired for security, supposedly paid in beer, end up beating people. And then, tragically, a fan, Meredith Hunter, was stabbed to death right near the stage while the Stones were playing.
And it was all captured on film.
In Gimme Shelter, the Maisels Brothers documentary, it's chilling to watch, became this symbol of the 60s dream turning sour, a really grim end to the decade.
So entering the 70s, they're huge, but dealing with the fallout of Altamont and looking to get more control,
yeah,
business-wise?
Definitely. They were really unhappy with their manager, Alan Klein, and their old Decca contract. They felt ripped off. So to fulfill their final obligation to Decca for one last single, they recorded Cocksucker Blues. Oh, yeah. Deliberately crude, raw, totally unreleasable. The idea was Depp wouldn't be able to put it out, thus ending the contract. It was a power move, and it worked.
That's brilliant in a way, taking control, which led to
Rolling Stones Records, their own label, formed in 1971. Total game changer. It gave them complete artistic and financial freedom.
And the first album on their own label was Sticky Fingers, March 71, with that cover.
The Warhol cover. The jeans with the real zipper. Instantly iconic. Caused a bit of a stir, obviously. And Sticky Fingers was also the debut of the logo.
The tongue and lips. Probably the most famous logo in music history.
Easily. Designed by John Pasch. Apparently, Jagger suggested looking at the Hindu goddess Kali's outstretched tongue for inspiration. Sean Egan called it the most famous logo in the history of popular music. Hard to argue.
They were innovating on the recording side, too, weren't they? The mobile studio.
Yeah, the Rolling Stones mobile studio. Ian Stewart's idea back in 68 basically put a recording studio in a truck, meant they could record wherever, whenever they wanted, outside normal studio hours and houses, wherever.
And other bands use it too.
Oh, yeah. Led Zeppelin recorded huge chunks of Led Zeppelin III and IV in it. Deep Purple immortalized it in Smoke on the Water, the Rolling Truck Stones thing, you know. It really changed how albums could be made.
Then came another big move, this one financial. Tax Exile.
Right. 1971, on the advice of their financial guru, Prince Rupert Lowenstein, they discovered they owed a massive amount in unpaid UK taxes. So they relocated primarily to the south of France.
To save money, basically.
Essentially, yes. They set up this complex structure through companies in the Netherlands and the Caribbean, reportedly got their tax rate down to something tiny, like 1.6%. Hugely controversial, but a very shrewd business decision for them at the time.
And this move directly led to the recording of Exile on May.
Exactly. Released May 72, largely recorded in the basement of Villa Nelcote, Keith's rented mansion in the south of France, using the mobile studio parked outside. It was apparently chaotic, legendary sessions.
And the reviews initially weren't great.
Some critics, like Lester Bangs initially, found it kind of muddy, sprawling, inconsistent. But opinions shifted pretty quickly. Now it's almost universally seen as maybe their masterpiece. A gritty, glorious double album born out of that whole chaotic exile period.
Okay, let's move into Act Three. We're talking 72 to 99, Evolution, Resilience, and World War III. This period sees big changes, starting with Mick Taylor leaving.
Yeah, late 74. Taylor's exit was complicated. He'd been there 5 years, felt like a bit of a junior citizen, as he put it. He felt his songwriting contributions weren't getting enough recognition.
And the drug scene was getting heavy.
That was definitely a factor, creating a tough environment. Ultimately, Taylor said he wanted to broaden his scope, try other things. He felt overshadowed by Mick and Keith.
So another guitar search begins. How did Ronnie Wood end up getting the gig?
Well, the recording sessions for Black and Blue in 76 basically turned into auditions. Big names tried out Frampton, Jeff Beck, Rory Gallagher, some maybe not even knowing it was an audition.
That's sneaky.
But Ronnie Wood, who already knew Keith well from the Faces and had played on a Stones track before.
Yeah.
He just fit. He actually turned Jagger down at first because he was still committed to the Faces. But eventually he joined in 75. Though, interestingly, he was just a salaried employee for years until the early 90s.
Shows that hierarchy was still there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the mid-70s, punk rock explodes. Mm-hmm. Did that make the Stones seem, well, old?
To some critics, yeah. They became a bit dismissive, record sales dipped a little, punk was raw, anti-establishment, and the Stones were, by then, rock royalty. Some definitely saw them as outdated.
But then came some girls. 1978. Massive comeback.
Huge. It felt like their direct answer to punk and disco, actually. Fast, basic, guitar-driven rock, but also that huge disco hit, Miss You.
Right. Miss You is everywhere.
And Beast of Burden shattered. Great singles. The album just clicked. It totally reestablished their popularity, especially with younger fans. Proved they could still evolve and deliver.
And that momentum carried into the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
Tattoo You.
1981. Another number one. And get this, it was mostly made up of outtakes, unfinished tracks from sessions going back years.
Seriously, tracks like Start Me Up.
Yeah, Start Me Up was originally a reggae-ish jam from the mid-70s. They reworked it. Even some of Mick Taylor's old guitar parts were on tracks like Waiting on a Friend. And they brought in Sonny Rollins, the jazz saxophone legend, for a couple of tracks. Just brilliant curation, really.
And the tours were getting bigger and bigger.
Colossal. The 81 American tour was described as their biggest, longest, most colorful production yet. Highest grossing tour of the year. This is also when Chuck Lavelle joined on keyboards.
Ah, Chuck Lavelle. Still with them today, right?
Yep. A constant presence, fantastic player, adds so much to their live sound.
But while they're breaking records on tour,
yeah,
behind the scenes, things are getting ugly between Mick and Keith. World War III?
That's what Keith called it. Yeah, a really serious rift developed. A lot of it stemmed from Jagger's solo ambitions. He signed a big solo deal with CBS. Keith felt Mick was losing interest in the Stones, putting himself first.
So, a real power struggle.
Big time. Led to a lot of animosity, creative friction. They were barely speaking at points.
And they both did solo albums during this time.
They did. Jagger had She's the Boss in 85, Primitive Cool in 87. Commercially successful. Keith released Talk is Cheap in 88, his first solo album. Critically acclaimed, fans loved it. But these solo projects kind of fueled the fire, you know?
Yeah, I can imagine. And during all this tension, they lost Ian Stewart.
Sadly, yes. December 1985. Passed away suddenly. He was always the quiet glue, the sixth stone in spirit. They held a private tribute concert for him. A really tough loss, even amidst all the fighting.
The album they made during this period, Dirty Work, 86, you can kind of hear the tension.
Oh, definitely. It was recorded when things were at an all-time low, as Keith put it. Jagger was apparently often absent. Richards really drove it. Keith explicitly called it World War III. Said the band almost broke up. It was that serious.
So what brought them back together?
Seems like the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction in early 89 was a catalyst. Mick, Keith, Ronnie, even Mick Taylor were all there, sharing that moment, acknowledging their legacy. It seemed to help them reconcile.
And that led to Steel Wheels.
Later in 89. And It was hailed as a real return to form. They sounded like a band again. It even had that track Continental Drift recorded in Morocco with the master musicians of Jujuka, showed they were still exploring.
And the tour for Steel Wheels was massive, too.
The Steel Wheels Urban Jungle Tour, 89-90, first world tour in 7 years, biggest production they'd ever done, highest grossing tour in the world at that time. It was a huge statement. The Stones are back. World War III was over for now.
And this was Bill Wyman's last tour.
It was. He'd been thinking about it for years, apparently. Officially left in 93 after 3 decades, went off to do his Rhythm Kings project, another era ending.
Who replaced him?
Daryl Jones came in on bass for the Voodoo Lounge album in 94. He'd played with Miles Davis, among others. Great player, still their touring bassist.
And Voodoo Lounge did well.
Yeah, critically, commercially.
Yeah.
Won a Grammy for Best Rock Album. New producer Don Was got a lot of credit for helping them find a fresh but still classic sound.
Now, here's something surprising. The Stones as internet pioneers
yeah.
in 1994.
It's true. November 94, they became the first major band to broadcast a concert over the internet. It's like a 20-minute segment streamed using this experimental high-bandwidth thing called the M-Bone.
At like 10 frames per second?
Something like that. Primitive by today's standards. But it was one of the very first public demos of streaming video, showed they were willing to embrace new tech early on. Pretty forward-thinking.
And they finished the 90s still touring strong.
Absolutely. Bridges to Babylon tour, No Security tour, still filling stadiums, still delivering incredible live shows. Their resilience is just something else.
Okay, Act 4. The 2000s to now. Still going strong into their sixth decade and beyond. Yeah. Let's talk about the 40th anniversary.
2002, they marked it with 40 Licks, that big greatest hits collection. Included 4 new songs, too. Sold over 7 million copies. Still massive.
And they did that huge concert in Toronto in 2003. for SARS relief.
Molson Canadian Rocks for Toronto, yeah. Almost half a million people, an incredible turnout, showed their cultural pull, using their fame for a good cause.
But there was some friction around digital stuff too, DVDs.
Ah, right. They did an exclusive DVD deal for their Four Flicks box set with Best Buy in the U.S. Other big retailers like HMV Canada, Circuit City, they boycotted it in protest. It was an early sign of the clashes coming between artists, labels, and retailers in the digital age. Still, they got inducted into the UK Music Hall of Fame as inaugural members in 2004.
Then came a new studio album, A Bigger Bang, 2005. First in nearly 8 years.
Yeah, got good reviews mostly. And it had that song, Sweet Neocon, Mick Jagger taking a direct shot at American neoconservatism.
Keith was worried about backlash.
A little bit initially, but he backed Mick's lyrics, showed they weren't afraid to be political, even if it might annoy some people.
And the tour for A Bigger Bang just broke all the records, didn't it?
Completely smashed them. 2005 to 2007, grossed over $500 million. $558 million. Guinness World Records for the highest grossing tour ever at that point. Included the Super Bowl halftime show in 06, too.
And that Rio concert on Copacabana Beach. Over a million people.
Just staggering, the logistics alone. They needed this incredibly complex sound system with relay towers stretching 2.5 kilometers down the beach just so everyone could hear the music in sync. Mind-blowing scale.
But even during this massive success, there were personal struggles.
Keith's
fall.
Yeah, fell out of a tree in Fiji. Needed cranial surgery. A real scare. And Ronnie Wood went into rehab for alcohol around the same time. Reminders that even rock gods are human, facing real battles. Martin Scorsese captured some of this era's live energy in his documentary Shine a Light in 2008.
Moving towards the 50th anniversary, big changes behind the scenes again. Management.
Yep. Prince Rupert Lowenstein, their manager for 40 years, stepped down in 2010. Apparently, he suggested they wind things down, sell assets, and they weren't having it. Joy Smith, their longtime lawyer, took over, still manages them today, won awards for it, shows they were still focused on the business side.
And Exile on Main Stage hitting number one again in 2010, 38 years later.
Unbelievable, isn't it? Just proves the timelessness of that album, reaching a whole new generation.
The 50th anniversary in 2012 was a big celebration.
A huge new book, The Rolling Stones, 50. New logo variation by Shepard Fairey, the documentary Crossfire Hurricane, and a new compilation, GRRR, with two brand new tracks, Doom and Gloom, and One More Shot. Still creating.
And the 50 and Counting Tour had loads of guest stars.
Yeah, it was like a victory lap with friends, Jeff Beck, Eric Clapton, Lady Gaga, Katy Perry, Taylor Swift. A real mix of legends and contemporary stars showed their reach across generations.
The return to Hyde Park in 2013 must have been emotional.
Hugely. First time playing there since the Brian Jones tribute in 69. Mick Taylor even guested, a real full circle moment. And Mick Jagger, around 2015, just flat out said, I'm not thinking about retirement. I'm planning the next set of tours. Just relentless.
And they proved it with that historic Cuba concert in 2016.
The Havana Moon concert. Free show, estimated 500,000 people. A massive cultural event. First big Western rock band to play there like that. Huge deal.
Same year, they go back to their roots with Blue and Lonesome.
Yeah, a fantastic blues covers album, raw, authentic. Eric Clapton played on a couple of tracks, went straight to number one in the UK, showed they could still top the charts just playing the music they first fell in love with.
And even in the last few years,
yeah,
still making news. New music, but also a huge loss.
The pandemic hit, obviously, postponed the No Filter tour, but they released Living in a Ghost Town in April 2020, finished it in isolation. It actually went to number one in Germany, made them the oldest artists ever to top the German singles chart.
That's incredible. And they set another record in 2020.
With the Goat's Head Soup reissue, yeah. Made them the first artist ever to have a number one album in the UK across six different decades. Six decades, just think about that.
Mind-boggling longevity. But then 2021 brought the devastating news about Charlie Watts.
Yeah, passing away at 80. Such a huge loss. Mm-hmm. The bedrock, the quiet engine of the band for nearly 60 years. Steven Jordan, who'd worked with Keith before, stepped in on drums. The band paid tribute to Charlie every single night on tour. But even with that loss, they were still the highest earning live act of 2021.
Which brings us almost up to date with Hackney Diamonds in 2023, their first album of new original songs in ages.
And what an album. Really strong reviews. It features the last two tracks Charlie ever recorded with them, which is incredibly poignant. And Bill Wyman came back to play bass on one track.
After 30 years away.
Wow. Yeah. And look at the guests. Paul McCartney, Elton John, Lady Gaga, Stevie Wonder. Just incredible. The single Angry with Sydney Sweeney in the video got huge buzz. They can still command attention like nobody else.
And they're already talking about more.
Seems like it. Jagger hinted a follow-up might be mostly done. Ronnie Wood confirmed plans for more music, more touring in 2025. They just don't stop.
Okay, Act 5. Let's try and unpack why. Why do they matter so much? What's the fabric of their sound, their impact, that ancient art of weaving thing Keith talks about?
Right. Musically, their genius is partly that ability to just soak up everything, blues, R&B, country, psychedelia, reggae, dance, world music, and make it sound like the Stones. Brian Jones was key early on with the sitar, dulcimer, bringing in those textures.
They basically defined hard rock, didn't they? That gritty blues bass sound.
Yeah, but always with that swing. That Wyman Watts rhythm section was crucial, strong, but subtle, with that kind of loose feel.
Driven by their influences, Muddy Waters, Chuck Berry, and Charlie Watts' jazz background.
Exactly. Watts wasn't a typical rock drummer. That jazz sensibility gave them a unique groove. And then you have the guitars, Richard's ancient art of weaving.
Explain that a bit more. It's not just lead and rhythm.
No, it's more like two guitars talking to each other, intertwining. Richards often sets the rhythm, and the other guitar weaves around it. Sometimes it's hard to tell who's playing what. Creates this dense, rhythmic tapestry. Very distinctive. And often, the band follows Keith's guitar rhythm more than the drums, which is unusual.
And Keith's use of open tunings is key to that sound.
Absolutely fundamental. Open E, open D, but especially that five-string open G tuning, taking off the bottom string, tuning the rest G, D, G, B, D. It gives you that thick, resonant, slightly dirty chord sound you hear on Honky Tonk Women, Brown Sugar, Start Me Up, countless others. It's his sound.
And the studio was pretty fluid, too. People swapping instruments.
Yeah, they weren't rigid about roles. Best musicians popping in, band members maybe playing different things. Kept it fresh, layered. And through it all, you have Jagger, the template for the rock frontman. Charismatic, provocative. He just changed the game.
And that Jagger Richards dynamic. Controlled madness.
That's Keith's phrase for it. Mick is the controller, and I'm the madness. That tension, that push and pull between them. Maybe that's the secret sauce right there. It fuels the creativity, even when it gets rough.
Beyond the studio, their live shows became legendary spectacles. How did that evolve?
Well, they went from tiny clubs where Jagger could barely move to halls, then arenas, then just massive stadiums. That 1969 U.S. tour was pivotal. Jagger called it a watershed because that's when they figured out how to properly amplify and light shows for huge venues. They basically invented arena rock logistics.
Making sure everyone could see and hear.
Exactly. And the stages got more and more elaborate, giant mirrors in 72, the Lotus stage that opened up in 75, inflatable props, circus tricks even.
Huh. Inflatable penises. They weren't subtle.
Not always. Then the huge stadium designs in the 80s with runways, moving sections, big screens, all designed to connect with those massive crowds.
Charlie Watts had that great quote about needing gimmicks, so they didn't just look like ants on stage.
Perfectly put. Fireworks, lights, theater. It became part of the experience, bridging that physical distance in huge stadiums.
And the Rio show pushed that to the absolute limit.
Yeah, needing relay speakers down a 2.5-kilometer beach just to keep the sound in sync for a million people. That's just incredible technical ambition driven by their massive appeal.
So pulling it all together, their enduring legacy, why do they still resonate?
Well, the longevity itself is astounding. Nobody survives like the world's greatest rock and roll band, as one critic said. The sales figures are insane. Over 250 million albums, most top 10 albums ever in the U.S. for any artist. Fourth best-selling group ever in the U.K. Just huge numbers, sustained over decades.
But it's more than sales, right? They changed culture.
Definitely. They were in the vanguard, bringing Black American music, blues, R&B to a massive global white audience in a new way. Muddy Waters himself said his record sales went up after the Stones hit. They helped America rediscover its own roots in a way.
And they stood up for things early on. Civil rights?
Yeah, refusing to play segregated venues back in the 60s, writing it into contracts. That rebellious image often had a progressive edge.
Rolling Stone magazine called them the great rock and roll rhythm section of our time.
High praise and deserved. And Steven Van Zandt had that great point about Jagger's vocals, that adult sex, conversational quality, opening doors for singers who weren't traditional crooners. Made different kinds of voices acceptable on pop radio.
They were business innovators, too.
Absolutely. Changed the whole model. Owning masters, their own label, pioneering stadium tours, merchandising. They turn rock and roll into a multi-billion dollar global business. They wrote the playbook, really.
And that constant reinvention, Rich Cohen called it 5 stylistic iterations.
Yeah.
They just kept changing.
So many times that they might as well be immortal, he wrote. From blues purists to psychedelic, hard rock, disco. They absorbed it all, but always sounded like themselves. Dangerous and vital even now.
The awards, the accolades, Hall of Fame, Grammys, even fossils, and a rock on Mars named after them.
Yeah, Rolling Stones' Rock on Mars. The recognition is immense, from official honors like UK stamps and coins for their 60th to quirky stuff like that. It shows how deeply embedded they are in culture.
And that stat about topping the UK charts in 6 different decades just speaks for itself.
It really does. Unprecedented.
So from those kids at Dartford Station sharing a love for the blues to just global icons, they've navigated everything, lineup changes, legal battles, internal wars, changing tastes, and always come back to that raw energy.
It's an incredible story. Passion, resilience, a fierce commitment to rock and roll, and somehow it still connects generation after generation. That authenticity, maybe mixed with that controlled madness, just keeps defying the odds.
So as they're still making music, still planning tours, what is it, really? What allows artists like the Stones to just defy age, defy genres, stay so vital for 60 plus years? What can we learn from their journey about collaboration, about resilience, even when things get incredibly tough, like World War III?
It makes you think, doesn't it? We definitely encourage you, dive back into their music, go back to the start, listen to the blues guys who inspired them, or watch one of those amazing concert films, Shine a Light, Gimme Shelter. With the Stones, there's always more to discover, more layers to peel back.